Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. If you are just joining in now for the first time, totally okay, because what we do today does not rely upon anything that we've done previously. But what we will do today is we're going to look at thinking about how law and narrative play with each other. The stories that we looked at the last couple of weeks, we're really just looking at the stories themselves, but not thinking about so much about their legal implication. And a question that I started with at the very beginning a couple of weeks ago was that there seems to be this kind of crisp delineation between stories in the Talmud and the legal texts. And what we'll see today is that they actually play off of each other and relate to each other in somewhat, I think, subtle and maybe surprising ways. And we read a statement which you may have been familiar with. It's become its own kind of song in the Aramaic, though then I'll read the rest in English. Amar Rava Machayv Inish Livsume Bepurya Ad Delo Yada Bein Aror Haman LeBaruch Mordechai. Rava said, a person is obligated to become intoxicated on Purim until one does not know the difference between the statement cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. We have the villain of the Purim story of Megillat Esther, Haman, and we have the hero, Mordechai, or one of the heroes, and it seems as if one is supposed to drink until they become sufficiently drunk that they can't distinguish between these two characters. Now, this is really the origins of what you may be familiar with, the practice of drinking and getting drunk on Purim. I worked for many years as a rabbi on a college campus, so this was just one of many excuses that students would have to drink. Yet, almost immediately following this text, which seems to make a very clear normative or halachic legal claim, we have the following rather dramatic story. Rabbah and Rabbi Zerah made their Purim feast with one another. They became drunk. Rabbah arose and slaughtered Rabbi Zerah. And the Aramaic there is shachteh, shechted him. The next day, he asked for mercy for him and caused him to live. The next year, Rabbah said to him, let master come and we shall make a Purim feast with one another. To which Rabbi Zerah said to him, not at every hour does a miracle occur. Now, there are a few interesting points to think about this story. One, very much is striking that you have this kind of cavalier way in which murder is just being dropped. It reminds us in some ways, I think, of the violence in the Megillah itself. There's something about that whole story, which is very violent, both in the threats to the Jewish people and then the concluding chapters, where the Jews defend themselves or in some cases seek revenge. Violence there is discussed in a rather, I think, cavalier fashion. We see that here in this text as well. This whole resurrection also seems to be something which just happens like that, as if it's not a big deal at all. Rabbi goes out and prays for mercy on his friend who he just killed, and all of a sudden that person is resuscitated, resurrected. The fact that we see this invitation extended yet again, Rabbah has just slaughtered his friend, and his immediate response is, hey, let's do this again next year. This seems like this was a good time. And then this final line here of Rabbi Zerah rejecting him, saying that not at every hour does a miracle occur, is itself sort of a response that makes sense within the story. So a number of ways I think that we can read this story itself. For our purposes, one of the questions is, the main questions is, how do these texts, 1 and 2, which again are just right next to each other in the Talmud, how do they relate to each other? Because on the one hand, we have a very clear normative statement that says you should go ahead and get drunk. And in the next statement, you have a story, or the next lines, you have a story which comes along and says, look at what happens when these two people, in fact, fulfilled this rule and got drunk. So how is this understood by later commentaries, specifically other halachic commentaries, Jewish legal commentaries? So first, the Rif, who is Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, is commentary usually found at the end of the Talmud that just has the halachic pieces and the conclusions, the somewhat redacted discourse, and then the legal conclusions from the Talmud. It's from 11th century North Africa. He writes, Rava said, a person is obligated to become intoxicated on Purim until he does not know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. Essentially, verbatim saying what the legal text said. So for the Rif, We can just ignore the story. It has no legal impact whatsoever. And it's just a nice story that you want to read. And kind of, I think, the standard approach to thinking about Talmudic stories and Talmudic law, which just completely bifurcates them. The Rif is doing the same thing here. Great, we have this nice story. It's completely irrelevant to the legal discourse. But not everyone feels the same way. In particular, we have the Baal HaMa'or, Ephraim Regensburg from the 12th century in Germany. And he says the following. He says, from this incident where Rabbah arose and slaughtered Rabbi Zerah, the following year he said to him, come, let us do it again, etc. Rabbah's statement, meaning the statement that we saw at the beginning here, and I'll get to this a little bit and who exactly this character is, Rabbah versus Rabbah. So we'll discuss that more towards the end. But basically, from the fact that this statement was initially said, but now we have this story that comes along where this murder takes place, Rabbah's statement was rejected, and halakha does not follow his opinion, and is not proper to act in this manner, meaning you should not get drunk. So we have two basic positions here on either side. One is the Rif, who says, only pay attention to Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, only pay attention to this text, the legal one. We can ignore text number two, the story, versus the Baal HaMa'or, who comes along and says, no. In fact, the story is here to counter that normative text. And the conclusion overall, the whole thrust of the Talmud, is to say that this legal text from source one has been rejected. Barry Wimpfheimer, who's a phenomenal scholar at Northwestern, has a book where he talks about the relationship between the stories and legal texts. And he writes the following about this. He says, the later narrative text, with its dire consequences, overwhelms the legal dictum and eliminates its mandated behavior as even optional behavior. The legal narrative has changed the law from mandate to prohibition. And we should realize how significant that is. We have a stated law. We then have a story that comes along, and at least according to the Baal Ma'or, the Ma'or HaKatan, that story completely trumps the legal text. Wimpfheimer continues, even as the commentaries and codes take this legal narrative means it's the narrative, the story, but it's in a legal context, it's about a legal matter, takes this legal narrative seriously as law, their reading of the narrative places the story within a narrow legal frame, transforming its content so that it becomes the mirror image of the dictum that precedes it. The story is made to look like a formal rule that states that one may not get inebriated on Purim. The discourse of reading that is interested in a prescriptive understanding of the law is only interested in the prescriptive content of the story and minds the story for that alone. So to summarize what he's saying is, if this is a way that kind of taking a, you have a hammer, so you hit, you think everything is a nail. Basically, what it's doing is it's saying this story that we encounter here, we want to actually understand this as a legal text, and the only way that we're going to look at it is through the eyes of legal jurisprudence, which means we basically have two different legal texts, one which is stated in a normative way, makes a claim about how about behavior, another which is stated as a story, but even so, at least according to the Ma'or HaKatan, we're going to read text number two as if it's really a legal document, and so we almost can kind of reframe it legally, and therefore it comes along and it attacks source number one and ultimately triumphs over it. That would be one way to read the narrative, that it is essentially just a legal text and we want to mine it for its legal text, but for nothing more. Now, there are other legal opinions, which I think read that text in perhaps more subtle ways, and we can see that by the rather odd conclusions that they come to. For instance, in source number six, Maimonides, Rambam, in his Laws of Purim and Chanukah writes, what is the nature of our obligation for this feast, meaning the feast on Purim? A person should eat meat and prepare as attractive a feast as his means permit. He should drink wine until he becomes intoxicated and falls asleep in a stupor. Not clear at all why Rambam is saying here that you should drink enough that you're going to fall asleep. But the Ramah, the Ashkenazi commentary on the Sephardi Shulchan Aruch, the code of law from the 16th century, helps potentially understand what's going on here. So the Shulchan Aruch in source 7, the code of Jewish law, writes, a person is obligated to drink on Purim until he does not know the difference between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai, which we've seen a number of times. But the Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, comes along and says, and there are those who say that one doesn't need to drink that much. Rather, he should drink enough so that he falls asleep. And through falling asleep, he will not know the difference between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai. Right? Very interesting. The Rambam just stated you should drink enough to fall asleep. And what the Ramah is saying, which I think is rather fascinating, is basically in theory, you could drink enough till really you have no idea what's going on. I rarely drink any alcohol, but at times I've gotten drunk, which have usually been on Purim. I don't think I've ever been to a state where I couldn't tell you the difference between Mordechai and Haman. But that's probably a pretty far out there level of intoxication. Or your other option, it seems, is drink enough, which is probably less, that you get tired, you fall asleep. And while you're asleep and in your dreamland, in a totally different state of consciousness, you, in theory, don't know the difference between Haman and Mordechai. Now, again, I think this is a somewhat strange interpretation of what this mitzvah would be, but I'm understanding this to be that we have the initial law as stated in the normative claim in source 1, and we have the narrative from source 2, which seems to be cautioning against getting too drunk. And so this text might be finding a way to kind of hybridize or find a middle ground between each of those core texts in the Talmud. Another interesting one, especially for me, I've always been into math. My father's a mathematician. The Magen Avraham, another legal commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, he comes along in the 17th century in Poland, and he says, there are those who say that one needs to drink until the point where one can't calculate the gematria of cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai, right? So this is, again, a far out there interpretation, but basically saying all you have to do is drink enough that you can no longer do arithmetic. You can't sum up the numerical values of the words of cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. Again, something that seems in some ways a rather lighthearted interpretation of this, but perhaps motivated again by the fact that these core texts, we really have a tension between the initial legal text and that narrative. Now, I think the final text in this set, which I think tries to find this kind of middle ground between the legal and narrative text, is from the Beit Yosef, Yosef Karo, in his commentary on Or Chaim, and he writes, it is a mitzvah to increase in feasting on Purim, source 9, and one must become intoxicated until they cannot distinguish between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. This is the statement of Rava in the first chapter of Megillah. However, he continues, the Ran, who's a traditional commentary, further writes in the name of Rabbeinu Ephraim that from the incident in the Gemara, where Rabba arose during the Purim feast and slaughtered Rabbi Zerah, it is evident that Rava's statement was rejected, and one should not act in this manner. Okay, kind of the two basic understandings we've seen, either this is law or no, it's been fully rejected. And he continues here, in Orchot Chaim, it is written that one is obligated to become somewhat intoxicated on Purim, but not to the point of full drunkenness, as drunkenness is a severe prohibition. There's no greater transgression than this, as it leads to illicit relations, bloodshed, and numerous other sins. Rather, one should drink slightly more than the usual amount of what they normally drink. Okay, so I like this final text there because it seems in my mind to be the best way of balancing the two initial texts. On the one hand, saying you should get drunk. At the same time, it's saying, but you shouldn't get too drunk. And not only should you not get too drunk, but the very act of getting too drunk is itself a sin, is itself something which is highly problematic, which we see from the narrative text, which again, I think is exaggerated, although some people do get very violent when they drink, but is showing what can happen when you drink too much in a very severe way. So this one says, go ahead, drink, but if you drink too much, it's actually a real problem. So again, we have our core legal text from the very beginning. One should get drunk to the point that they don't know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. And then we have the narrative text of one rabbi slaughtering another rabbi, and various ways that we can either understand this. The first, which is the riff, is ignore the second text, focus on the first. The second, which is the Mor HaKatan, says the second text comes to completely eviscerate the first text. And then we have different ways of creating some kind of middle ground, either just drink enough until you fall asleep, just drink enough until you can't do gematria, you can't do math, or drink a little bit, get a little bit drunk, but definitely don't drink too much, because then that is a transgression. Before we go a little further in our analyzing exactly what might be happening here in a much more subtle way to understand the relationship between the legal text and the narrative text, I want to first do a slight exploration of what exactly is happening on Purim to begin with. Why do we have this holiday? What is kind of the major thrust of this day? And Jeffrey Rubenstein, who I've mentioned before, has an article where he discusses more the nature of Purim, less his analyses of Agadic texts, which I've quoted before. And he quotes this 20th century sociologist, Victor Turner, who says that he studied the ritual and social processes that occur during intervals in the normally structured state of society. So you have society as it goes along, and then you have punctuated moments where it functions slightly differently. By social structure, Turner means the matrix of roles, statuses, and positions governed by social phenomena, such as law, custom, institution, and cultural tradition. Society enters what Turner calls a liminal time, a betwixt and between, or threshold period. No longer do power and privilege, status and role, law and institution, important for us, determine social interrelatedness. Society enters a time outside of time, where alternative modalities of social relatedness appear. The most common modality of social organization that takes place within liminality is what he calls communitas. As opposed to societas, or structure, communitas is characterized by equality, immediacy, and the lack of social ranks and roles. A leveling process brings about the dissolution of structure, the absence of social distinctions, a homogenization of roles, the disappearance of political allegiance, the breakdown of regular borders and barriers. So what is happening on the holiday of Purim, which happens in other kind of carnival days in other societies, is that we often have the structures of our society, which law, certain kinds of norms, regulations, borders, hierarchies between different roles, and there are ways in which those are really important for society to function. And in some ways, though, those are artificially constructed. And there's a way in which they set up barriers which might be good for society's functioning, but actually are in some ways artificial, and barriers that we don't want to assume have full, really ontological value, full real meaning. So imagine for a moment, right, you're at work and you have a supervisor and you have someone who is being supervised. There's a hierarchy that exists there for the functioning of that organization. And yet to assume that that hierarchy reflects some kind of essential hierarchy between those two people would be highly problematic. And yet there are ways in which I think we internalize those different structures. And so what happens on Purim? Purim is a day in which we can kind of break down those barriers, break down those societal structures. And that reminds us of the ultimate equality between people, even if they have different status in society during normal times. This happens in sometimes dramatic ways in religious contexts. For instance, in yeshivas, where someone can have a Purim spiel and you have the head of the yeshiva, a Rosh Yeshiva, who is often highly respected and valorized. It's not uncommon in traditional yeshivas where people don't even refer to a Rosh Yeshiva in the second person. They will say, "What does the Rosh Yeshiva think?" And yet on Purim, students can go ahead and mock their teachers, mock their rabbis, mock their Rosh Yeshivas. And part of, I think, what's happening there is not to diminish the respect that a teacher deserves, but also is a kind of reminder that at a fundamental level, we are all created in the image of God. There is a kind of equal, essential worth to every human being. And so that, in many ways, is what's happening on Purim. And one way in which this happens is through the breakdown of, as Rubinstein writes here, norms, borders, and even laws. And while we might see a kind of a value to that, I think there's a question that we may want to ask ourselves, which is, how can this occur within a religious system which itself is so predicated and founded upon laws themselves? So we'll get to that in a moment. Now, Rubinstein also continues in his article. He says that jurists gave permission to dress in the clothing of the opposite sex, normally a violation of a biblical prohibition of cross-dressing, for the sake of Purim joy. Status reversals demoted the rabbi or Rosh Yeshiva, thereby contravening the laws of respect incumbent upon students. Other such examples abound. Drunkenness itself, not ipso facto opposed to any law. There's no law in the Torah that says you can't get drunk, although certainly at odds with the tenor of Jewish morality, may result in the destruction of property and inadvertent or perhaps intentional physical injury. Certain law codes, however, absolved inebriates of culpability. Moses Isserles, who we saw before, the great Ashkenazi codifier of Jewish law, notes that some authorities say that if a man injures his neighbor as a result of too much Purim joy, he is free from paying damages. Isserles also rules that one may wear clothes that contain certain types of forbidden mixtures of fabrics. There's certain things you're not supposed to wear, wool and linen together, but you can do that on Purim. Rabbi Judah Mintz observes that several rabbis ruled that any food stolen in the course of Purim joy, even without permission, is not considered thievery. Not only is stealing sanctioned, but responsibility for damages incurred during thefts or drunken boisterousness is abolished. I mean, think of what's being described here, right? Both on a societal level, a moral level, but especially a Jewish legal level, we're seeing here that all these rules that we're normally quite punctilious about are just thrown out the window. You can imagine now a raucous party taking place. People are getting drunk. They're running around. They're looting. They're causing damages. There might be even injuring people. And basically, no one's held accountable at all for their actions. This seems to be dramatically opposed to the normal state of affairs in Jewish culture. And also, it seems strange that we have these various authorities claiming, actually, that somehow this holiday of Purim absolves us of other standard laws. Especially strange, since the whole holiday of Purim is itself really a rabbinic law. And we're going to say that now you're free in certain ways to steal food on Purim because you're drunk and you're following this rabbinic mandate. It seems very strange, highly surprising. I will add, it doesn't seem as if you can just go ahead and do these things willy-nilly. It's only if you're inebriated. But even so, that seems like a rather strange and surprising fact. So this itself is surprising. It's strange. Perhaps that we can understand to some extent, although it's challenging for me, the rationale behind this is because we have to have the state of communitas where we break down these boundaries to have this one day of the year where there's a sense that these artificial constructs that we have that create barriers that are necessary for a functioning society are also important to break down so we have a sense of the ultimate equality of all people. Again, that seems strange to me. People attacking each other, looting, rioting would not be the way that I would want to go about establishing that sense of equality of all. But there's a fascinating piece which is also at play here, which is, it seems as if you go back especially to our original text, that we are saying in a paradoxical way, on the holiday of Purim, right? Let's go back to the original text here, right? A person's obligated to become intoxicated on Purim until one does not know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. And the argument that we're trying to make is there's a value in people becoming drunk and undermining laws, undermining the system itself so that there's some kind of sense of equality at play here. But if this is true, there's a paradox because we are saying essentially there is a law that you should get drunk so that you will then go ahead and undermine all these other laws. And Barry Wimpheimer picks up on that in source number 12. And he writes, though the rabbinic Purim is a topsy-turvy inversion day with an antinomian bent, an anti-law bent, the rabbis gave painstaking attention to the few commandments that apply on Purim. Rabbinic literature mines Esther for its laws, turning the niceties of a biblical comedy into specific mandates whose every nuance is legislated. Think about that. You read the Purim story and it's a farce. And now we're saying, if you read the go through the rabbinic writings on Megillat Esther, they distill from this farce a whole structure of laws for the day. This punctilious legislation is an attempt to assert control over folk cultural practices. There is significant irony in contemporary traditional communities on Purim. Rabbinic overexertion of the laws of Purim has led legal-minded individuals to compel themselves and others to attend punctiliously and with all seriousness to the reading of the Megillah, a work of bawdy comedy. The image of a costumed clown ritually reading the Megillah with more precision than the weekday Torah reading is more than a bit farcical. And so you walk into Purim, into synagogue on Purim, and there's a whole structure, and people want to read the Megillah. And sometimes, right, the rabbi or the gabbai will get up and say, make sure that you have to hear every single word. And so even if we're going to sort of cheer and bang our groggers, bang the table when we hear Haman's name, we're not going to continue until that quiets down so everyone can hear the words that follow. And so you have this incredible paradox at play, where on the one hand, right, the image that he has here is some guy or woman is dressed up as a clown reading from the Megillah, and yet we're so careful to make sure that people should maintain quiet so that every word can be heard. Whereas if you walk into most synagogues on a typical Saturday, typical Shabbat, people are going to be talking during the Torah reading. You won't be able to hear as well, because there's really a mitzvah to hear every word of the Megillah, which is different from hearing the Torah being read, aside from a couple of exceptions, but on a standard Shabbat. There's more than that, right? We have all these mitzvot that you're supposed to do on the holiday of Purim, in terms of giving gifts, etc. And this day, which is meant to be this carnivalesque day, has carnival-esque qualities to it, in the way that people are dressing up, etc. And yet, there are all these different mandated rules that people are trying often to be careful about, or at least the rabbis were. Wimfheimer continues, the story of Rabba and Rabbi Zeira is itself reminiscent of some of the upheaval of Purim. Two distinguished rabbis with no hint of violent tendencies dine together and get inebriated, following not only the mandate of law, but also the precedent of King Ahasuerus, the king in the story, and the Jews of Persia. As a result of their excess drinking, one rabbi kills the other, slaughtering him in cold blood. There is humor in the way in which this killing is narrated without effect, as if the slaughtering of a rabbi were as mundane as the initial invitation to dinner. Like King Ahasuerus, Rabba remembers his actions in the morning and undoes them by bringing Reb Zeira back to life. The next year, Rabba invites Reb Zeira again, an invitation that presumably includes feast, drinking, and the possibility of decapitation. Reb Zeira's comical refusal ends the story in blatant comedy. So for Barry Wimfheimer, the story itself of Rabba and Rabbi Zeira that we see is meant to, in some ways, be comical as a mirroring of the original story of Purim itself. Okay. But Barry Wimfheimer then continues with a text here that I think is significant and is really in the direction that I want to now think about this. He says, Rabba, as it applies to to how we think about law and stories relating to each other, Rabba's dictum, the initial statement, you must get drunk, is both an attempt to assert control over the practice of inebriation by legislating it, and an attempt to make the ultimate hedonistic activity, getting drunk, a purposive religious event, right? One would think that getting drunk, losing control, is exactly the opposite of what this religious legal system wants to achieve. And yet, it itself is a mandate, according to Rabba. We'll see the footnote in a moment, but the initial texts over here, the two characters at play, Rava and Rabba, may in fact be the same person. And for Barry Wimfheimer, he understands them to be the same person. We'll see the footnote in a second where he makes that claim. So he goes on to say, the story and the dictum work well together. The story describes the very rabbi who struggles to control the uncontrollable as being himself out of control. And yet, the next year, Rabba is willing to do the whole thing all over again. Reb Zera's comic relief stands as a comic critique of the interaction of rabbinic legislative control and the carnivalesque character of the holiday of Purim. Any attempt to read the story and dictum entirely within a framework of rules underreads, I love that expression, this material by preventing the story from critiquing the normative strategies themselves and the ambivalent impulses that stand behind them. So here's what's happening, right? Purim is meant to be a carnivalesque day. Part of what it means to be carnivalesque is to lose control, is to break through a kind of society, the elements of society that are normative, that are legal, that are rigid. And yet, Rubba comes along and tries to dictate or mandate that kind of drunkenness, that kind of undermining of law, which is itself a paradox. And the story comes along to even undermine Rubba himself. And so what you basically have here is the halakhic text comes to legislate breaking boundaries, and the story comes to critique the attempt to legislate the breaking of boundaries, which I think is itself just fascinating. And is basically, though, what I think Barry Wimpheimer is trying to do here. He's also trying to say that the whole enterprise of rabbinic law, and really law in general, right, is meant to be subverted by Purim. And the way in which this is structured by the story undermining the attempt to legislate, even the subversion, is essentially coming along and saying it's expressing an ambivalence that the Talmud itself has, I think, with a kind of over-legislation. At the end of the day, not everything can be legislated. The footnote, by the way, which he says here, right? He says any combination of the two names is possible. Is it Rava, Rubba? And we don't know. There are definitely two different characters, two different rabbis, but we're not sure how they're referred to in the Talmud. And he writes here, for my purposes, it is more powerful to assume that the name to which the dictum is attributed is the same as the name of the story's problematic protagonist. Since Rubba is Rabbi Zeir's contemporary, it's likely that the story is about Rubba. I likewise chose to attribute the statute to Rubba. What he's basically saying is this makes a lot better sense literarily to say that the same person who is coming along and saying we need to legislate this kind of carnival activity is the same person who then has this own farcical story, which comes to undermine the attempt to legislate the carnivalesque activity. Now, one could argue this is a local conversation. It has to do with Purim. Purim is this one day of communitas. It's Yotzei Min HaKlal. It is a day which is unlike any other. And so for the rabbis to attempt to control this one particular day, that itself is somewhat problematic. And that's why the story comes along to undermine the attempt to legislate that. But I actually think that there is broader implications here that have to do more generally with how the rabbis might think about Jewish law and attempts at legislation. And in order to do that, we're going to look at one other story or one other law that comes along with the story. And this has to do with the question of suffering, which we addressed in a little bit in our first session, and is found in the Tractate of Brachot. And there we read, again, the same character, but I don't think that's significant. Rava and some say Rav Chista said, Source 15, if a person sees that suffering has befallen him, he should examine his actions. As it is stated, we will search and examine our ways and return to God. Okay, you see that you're suffering. You should attribute that to at least initially think you must have done something wrong. You deserve this suffering. So go ahead, examine your ways to see if you can find something that you've done wrong. If he examined his ways and found no transgression, he may attribute his suffering to dereliction in the study of Torah. As it is stated, happy is the man whom you punish, Lord, and teach out of your law. Basically saying that God punishes people in order to direct them to study more Torah. So we have basically two approaches. You're sitting there, you're suffering in some way. First, see if there's some actions that you, some of your behavior, which itself is problematic, and that you're essentially being punished. If you can't find any misbehavior, then you need to think about how you're spending your time. And if you're not actually studying Torah, the purpose of your afflictions here is to direct you to study more Torah. But what happens if you actually are spending your free time studying Torah? And if he did attribute his suffering to the dereliction of the study of Torah and did not find this to be so, he may be confident that these are afflictions of love. As it is stated, for whom the Lord loves, he rebukes. A cryptic statement that somehow, if you are suffering, and there's no obvious reason why you're suffering, it must be that somehow that's an expression of God's love for you. So what can that possibly mean? I think there are a number of ways we may want to explain this. But Rashi comes along and says, how are sufferings chastisings of love? God makes people suffer in this world, even if they are free of sin, in order to increase their reward in the world to come, so that they will receive more than their actions merit. Basically, the way we all have it, there's some kind of scale. You're going to get what you deserve, but you can either get that in this world or in the world to come in the afterlife. And it seems as if to receive that reward in the afterlife is better, maybe because it's eternal, I'm not entirely sure. But if that's the case, if you suffer now in this world, that means that the scales have tilted in this direction, they're going to tilt back, and you're going to get your compensation in the world to come. That should overall be a net benefit to you. Okay, we could have a longer discussion about whether or not we agree with this, if this is helpful theologically. But I think we can all understand that this is at least an idea that we've encountered or that we've entertained. Now, it seems, though, as if this is a certain kind of normative claim. And I wouldn't say this is exactly a halakha, a law, but it's basically saying this is what you should do. If you're suffering, you should have some kind of internal introspection, see if your behavior is proper, see if you're learning enough Torah. And if not, you should recognize that theologically, this is ultimately for the good. And yet, we then have a story that immediately follows this normative text in source 17. Rabbi Chiya ben Abba, Bar Abba, fell ill, and Rabbi Yochanan went in to visit him. He said to him, "Are your sufferings welcome to you?" He replied, "Neither they nor their reward." He said to him, "Give me your hand." He gave him his hand, and he raised him. Rabbi Yochanan once fell ill, and Rabbi Chanina went in to visit him. He said to him, "Are your sufferings welcome to you?" He replied, "Neither they nor their reward." He said to him, "Give me your hand." He gave him his hand, and he raised him. Why could not Rabbi Yochanan raise himself? Remember, he was the person who came in the first case to visit the first ill rabbi, and he was able to lift him up, somehow heal him. So why can't Rabbi Yochanan raise himself? They replied, I think it's a beautiful phrase, "The prisoner cannot free himself from jail." Sometimes, right, even the greatest of us still need other people to come and give us support. But this text is, in certain ways, maybe surprising. These are great sages. If it's true that if someone is suffering, they should either introspect and see what they've done wrong, and if they've done so, and they are actually, their behavior is pure, right? They should welcome the suffering. After all, it is a suffering of love, seemingly because you're going to receive all this reward in the afterlife. And these rabbis seem to recognize this. And that's why they say, "We're not accepting these, neither they nor their reward." But that's surprising. If you're a pious person and you have this kind of complete belief, so you know that the reward you're going to get in the afterlife is even greater than the suffering that you have here, why would you not welcome them? And yet, these rabbis are incapable of withstanding the suffering that they are experiencing in this moment. And so you have here is a story that I think in certain ways comes and undermines the normative text. Even the greatest sages can't live up to the ideal which is being stated in this particular normative text in source 15. And perhaps what the message then is of source 17 is one, maybe faith isn't easy. To truly have faith that the suffering you're experiencing now will be paid back is itself not obvious or not something which is easy to have. Maybe there's a sense that even if you feel like that's true and you know that's true, to overcome your immediate suffering is something which is not actually possible. In which case, is it really helpful to be told that, great, you're suffering now, but you're going to receive a greater reward in the world to come? But if the suffering is so great that you don't want that reward, is that really a helpful claim? And I'd say there's also an element here, which I read this as kind of for pastoral instruction. Sometimes when we're dealing with other people and they're suffering, we try and find ways to explain away that suffering. And we may have inclinations in that direction, but kind of the final text here in 17 is coming along and saying, at the end of the day, suffering really is so painful that even the greatest sages would trade away the rewards of the afterlife for the sufferings that they would receive in this world. And so what you have here then is, I think, this kind of beautiful interplay between the normative text and the story, that the normative text can make this one claim. Yes, there's a kind of impetus towards the sense that the world is just, and that if we're suffering, God is actually doing that on account of something that we've done wrong. And if not, it's ultimately for our best. And yet there's a counterclaim that gets made by the story that's actually a much harder reality to kind of live in. And this, I think, therefore, is going back to our original text that we looked at, part of the way in which the stories and the law can play with each other, which is that there's an element which that a normative claim can dictate to some extent the way in which we live our lives. And yet there's a kind of greater texture to life as it is lived that somehow transcends just the normative claim and can be, and the normative claim gets, or the law itself can kind of be pushed back on. Now, one way I think to think about this, and with this, we're going to move to our conclusion of law and narrative, is that even law itself, at least legal discussion in the Talmud, is more than just law as a code. And for this, I want to turn to a great book by Chaim Saiman, who's a law professor at Villanova, but writes a lot about Jewish things as well. And he wrote a book called Halakha, the Rabbinic Idea of Law, where he says the following. He says this book, meaning his book Halakha, will argue that Halakha is not a body of regulations, but a way, a path of thinking, being, and knowing. Over the course of several chapters, we will see how the rabbis use concepts forged in the regulatory framework to do the work other societies assign to philosophy, political theory, theology, and ethics, and even to art, drama, and literature. What he's saying is, when you open up the Talmud, and if someone were to say, what are you studying? You'd say, I'm studying Jewish law. But actually, what you're really doing in those legal conversations is exploring things that really transcend just the genre of legal discussion and actually bear on all kinds of other departments if they were in a university framework. And he goes on here later in the book. He says, what is beauty? What is truth? What is the best political ordering? The Talmud anchors such macro questions in the context of a specific mitzvah and its obligations. Thus, the issue of how many judges should sit on a panel is approached by considering whether the role of a court is to secure social peace or to determine legal truth, which is really a philosophical question. Which books are deemed part of the Bible, which sounds again like a legal question, is assessed through a discussion of which books are rescued from a building burning on Shabbat or which scrolls transmit ritual impurity. What we now call the life-work balance is negotiated in the Talmud by weighing a worker's contractual obligations towards his employer versus his religious obligations of daily prayer. In brief, what the Greeks pursued through reflective and speculative philosophy, the rabbis read into, out of, and through halacha. And so his point, what he's trying to do is to really explain what is happening in the halachic discourse, the legal discourse of the Talmud, which is to say, it's not really about the laws themselves. It's also about that, but it's about so much more. It's a conversation of ethics and aesthetics and political theory, which is so much more than just a question of a particular legal point. And once we understand that to be the case, well, now the halachic parts of the Talmud are so much broader than what we may have initially thought. And so that also means that the narrative pieces of the Talmud relate to them in a much more obvious way. If before we could easily dichotomize between law and story and lore, well, now that law means so much more, so the stories are more likely to bear on the legal texts themselves, because they're both a conversation about something far greater than just a particular interesting story or legal discourse. And I think Barry Wimpheimer really drives this home when he says the following. He says, a cultural native is one who knows the explicit rules of law, but also the implicit narratives that contextualize those explicit rules, even holding out the possibility of overruling them. And so I think Barry Wimpheimer is saying that societal norms can shift or can be applied differently. Sometimes there are exemptions, and sometimes they can include a lot of nuance, which cannot be easily described purely by a law code. And so the law and the stories together give us really the full texture of Jewish life. Meaning, if you were to just read a specific law book about whatever it would be, you might think you have an understanding of what Jewish society really is, but you don't, because that law actually is coming to say so much more. And that's why, in some kind of crazy way, it's possible that on Purim, you can get drunk and cause damage, even though from a purely technical legal perspective, that there's no way that could possibly be allowed, because certain elements of the law get suspended in the face of this day of this carnivalesque kind of day. And you only really can understand the fullness of Jewish life by understanding the full legal discussion and understanding the stories that are also found in the Talmud. And that ultimately both of them are coming to do something which is far more than just legislate specific behaviors, but actually, I think, to really describe the full society, the full Jewish life of the Talmud, or what the rabbis idealized as what society might look like. But society is not just a set of laws that can be prescribed, but is actually something which is much richer, much more nuanced. And in a beautiful way, I think the case study that we saw today demonstrates that you can have an attempt to legislate even this carnivalesque behavior, but a story comes along to undermine that. And ultimately, it's very difficult to articulate the fullness of what Purim is meant to be. And the day itself, when we're kind of supposed to drink, but drinking can get out of hand, there's a lot of nuance there, which is difficult to articulate in any simple way. And the goal of the Talmud, I think, is to try and do its best at articulating the fullness of Jewish life. And I just go, you know, further to say that ultimately it can't even be fully articulated, but it ultimately just needs to be lived. And so we have both the lived reality and then also the discussions. And that together is really the fullness of Jewish life.